This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today hasn't been here for a while, and that's my fault. Stan Soloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. Welcome back, Stan.
Great to be here, Mark. Thanks.
Thanks for coming in. Traffic wasn't fun for either of us today, but, coming into D.C.'s rarely a good time. I don't want to belabor this point, but probably a lot of people don't know you except from PSC. So I happen to know you were a college DJ, but
many moons ago.
Slightly different gig. But you were also at the Pentagon for a while.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I did the second half of the Clinton administration. I was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. I had the acquisition portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was what they call dual-hatted to run Secretary Cohen's Defense Reform Office. So we had two organizations, one focused on broader defense-wide or department-wide reengineering and the other on the acquisition reform initiatives. It started, of course, during the Clinton administration and continued started in the first term and continued well into the second term.
Right, Mr. Gore's program.
Well, it was that and, of course, Secretary Perry and Paul Kaminsky and that team, Colleen Preston. And then I came in, took Colleen's slot in the second half.
How'd you transition from that to PSC?
It was we were getting towards the end of the term, and a lot of us who were politicals were thinking about what we were going to do, and actually got recruited, and I knew PSC from my previous life before the Pentagon, and had a lot of respect for the organization. Had actually never thought about going to a trade association, but I was really intrigued by what they did, and then sort of the attitude the leadership had about where they wanted the organization to go. So it turned out to be a great move. They haven't been able to fire me yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a great fit for you because it fit right in largely to a lot of the things that you were doing.
Sure. Yeah, the acquisition portfolio and a lot of the things going on with acquisition and technology. It was a good fit.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about PSC before we get into some of the other issues. PSC's been around for a while, as they say.
Yeah, 42 or 43 years, I always forget. This is 42 years now.
Okay.
Not a bad start. It started off a handful of companies back in the early 70s, banded together around a couple of issues. Ironically, one of them was the government's schizophrenia around outsourcing and insourcing, and then also the appropriate role for federal-funded research and development centers, which to some extent continues to also be an issue, not as much as it used to be, but still there. And over the years, it's grown. I came in 2001 after the administration, and we had, at that point, about 110, 120 companies. But it has we've expanded as the industry has matured. It's timing is often everything, and we've been very fortunate in that the whole professional services sector in the economy has matured dramatically in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
And therefore in the government as well. And so it's enabled us to grow a lot and spread our wings and deal with a whole lot of issues, agencies, Congress, and so forth.
Okay, so when people think professional services, they usually think, okay, that's probably a MOBIS kind of gig. You're a little bit broader than
yeah,
that.
We're pretty much now across the entire services spectrum. I think the term professional services in the term of art really refers to management consulting and that kind of a role. But by and large now, it is a much broader community of capabilities. Our membership, we have almost 380 companies, I guess, now. They do just about everything you can imagine in terms of services for the federal government, from base operating support and all the way on up to the most sophisticated technology capabilities. But it's all centered around providing a service to the government.
Okay. So I took a cursory look at the, first of all, the website, if you're interested, is pscouncil.org, pscouncil.org. I took a cursory look at the website before today's show, and you have a few more committees and task task forces than I would have thought.
Well, we are structured to kind of do a couple of things. Our principal role, as is the case for many trade associations, is advocacy, is to work on policies that are create a market that's open and fair and competitive, serves the government well, and but also supports a vibrant private sector. And that involves a lot of different pieces, and so we're focused on, we're organized around both key customer sets around Homeland Security, National Security, Intel, Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services, International Development, but also around key policy areas like acquisition, contract finance, and so forth. So we're up to almost 16 committees and task forces now, but we're actually in the process of kind of doing a little bit of restructuring to really make sure that we're focused right and that we're aligned with where the industry is going. So we operate largely through a task force and committee structure. We have a board and an executive committee like most organizations. We put on a lot of different kinds of events for our members. We have a very large annual conference, which is really our hallmark event, but then other programs all the way throughout the year.
Okay. You have a very engaged membership, mm-hmm. though, because right. every committee I looked at is like a mini who's who in particular niches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been very lucky that we have leadership that's very engaged, and that obviously at the functional level, people are very engaged. You know, it's like any other business. It depends on what you're doing and if you can deliver some value for it. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the advantages we have and something that we pride ourselves on is that we're very much led and driven by our CEO community, not a handful, but a very, very broad range of very senior executives, but also equally by folks at a functional operational level. So folks in the business development, the contracting, legal, and other related communities. So that mix of input to the agenda and that mix of drivers to the agenda really, I think, gives us the impetus that we have.
Okay, so when that was going to be my next question, weirdly enough, because I look at these things and I see just a ton of CEOs there, and I'm wondering where the other people came in to play. So for a company, Cisco, mm-hmm. relatively
right.
new member,
right?
Yeah, I know the head of federal here. You know, you're not going to get Chambers to
right.
come down
right.
and play. He may visit once right. in a while, but. How deep do you dive into Cisco?
Well, they're a relatively new company, but it's a great example. We just spent, one of my staff just spent some time with them yesterday with their senior team, plotting out their engagement and the strategy for their involvement. I think what happens in a membership organization is it's all about how you engage the people. So we have Pat Finn, who's the head of all federal. He's effectively a C-level executive. He runs federal for Cisco.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Balutis is a well-known figure in the federal IT community. He's very involved. And now the plan is, okay, we have the leadership, but now how do you help the functionals? And so if you look at people who attend a typical Department of Homeland Security task force meeting that we have, it's not typically C-level. It's people who are working in and around the Department of Homeland Security or dealing with policy issues in Homeland Security and so forth. So the committees and task forces are largely populated by the operational folks, and the leadership drives the agendas and the direction.
Okay, so you're a C3 or C6?
C6.
Six. Okay, yeah. how much time do you spend on the Hill?
Personally, it varies dramatically. There are some periods of time when I'm up there. A lot of other times I don't spend a lot of time up there. We have a great staff, great team. Our executive vice president, Alan Shavatkin, is widely recognized as one of the leading procurement law experts in the country.
Yep.
And we have a great team working policy. But I've been spending more time up there on some of the IT issues lately because there's some small working groups that have been created to talk about where we go next and so forth, kind of open discussions. So it varies. I mean, you know, it's one of the great things about my job is it's not on the Hill all the time. It's not in the agencies all the time. It's not with the companies all the time. It's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, but you're always moving.
it's a little busy.
You still doing that thing with Grant Thornton? Because I used to see you there every year when they released their report.
The industry study, sure.
Yeah.
We do the industry survey with Grant Thornton, and actually in even numbered years, this being one, we also with Grant Thornton do the acquisition policy survey, which is just going into the field this month.
Cool.
And we'll report that out in the fall.
I haven't done much with Grant since Cal went down mm-hmm. to North Carolina,
right.
but that's neither here nor there. You have also, you mentioned your big annual event, mm-hmm. but I'm looking at your calendar on your website, and I don't see an empty day except for Easter Sunday, you know?
Well, you know, again, it's as you get larger, the challenge is always to maintain focus on your core, but also deliver something for your membership. And so we have a fair amount of programming. Some of it's very specific.
Fair amount?
Well, you know, it's we're always looking to do more. We have some major events during the course of the year. We have a leadership summit, which is CEOs only in January. We do a spring conference, which is really market focused. But you're right. A lot of the committees and task forces, if you put it all together, I forget the number, but it's the number of total programs, events, and meetings during the course of a year is sometimes a little daunting.
Mm-hmm.
But again, having a great team and then having a lot of input from the membership and helping drive agendas that actually matter to people really makes a big difference.
How often are you able to get feds to attend your sessions, either just to attend or to speak?
All the time. Okay. We have very little trouble. We've never had ethics issues and so forth. They have to go through ethics clearance and all that,
right.
So it's never been an issue. And we have found that a lot of our federal colleagues are eager to get out, sometimes feel a little bit hamstrung by the process, the bureaucracy of getting approvals, travel budgets, and so forth. But we just had our secondary conference, we call it, a smaller conference, our spring conference in Florida, and we had some very senior folks who said, I'll be there heck or high water, and they were there. And those who couldn't because of budget made arrangements on their own to make sure we had VTC connections. So we actually find that the folks we deal with on government side, and that's the acquisition policy, the CIO community, and so forth, and senior agency officials are very accessible.
Cool. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Stan Soloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. You can find him at pscouncil.org. Back after these. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today again is Stan Soloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. One of the things you may not know about PSC is they are also a publisher. Do you want to tell us a little bit about not just the newsletter, but that magazine?
Yeah, we have a quarterly magazine called Service Contractor. We actually had thought about starting a magazine years ago, and then had a transaction or acquisition, merger, whatever you want to call it, with another association that actually had a magazine. We decided to keep it going, and I think I'm actually quite proud of it. I think that the topical information in there, the quality of the thinking, we tap outside sources. We don't write all of it internally. We have a lot of our CEOs write for it. We have a lot of thought leaders writing for it, and it goes out to about 5,000 people plus is on the website, so it's easily accessible and probably gets about 10,000 visits a month. Or quarter.
It's a good issue. Problem. Yeah.
And so it comes out quarterly, and it's become, I think, a real quality publication. I'm real proud of it.
Do you have an advisory board for that?
No, we do it. The advisory board, the editorial board, is our media relations manager, myself, and Alan Shavatkin, and we sit around and sort of theme out an issue and come up with the basic questions. And we have features in there that are regular, like we have what we call a sounding board, where we have three board members respond to the same question.
Mm-hmm.
We have interviews with newsmakers whether on the Hill or in the agencies. In fact, in the upcoming issue, Beth Cobert is writing for it, from the deputy director of OMB is writing a piece on innovation. We have folks like Ann Altman from IBM writing on convergence in the technology space. And so there's some, I think, real substantive media stuff. And then, of course, we have a lot of legal issues, a lot of legal analysis and so forth. So I'm real proud of it.
And free.
And free.
And on the web. So if you go to pscouncil.org, click on the publications button on the top nav bar, and there you go. let's talk about some issues impacting your membership community and the government community, government contracting community at large. One of our favorite things we can't let go of is LPTA. it's not new.
No.
So what's going on here, and when's the pendulum going to swing back? What's your magic eight ball say?
Well, I wish I had a magic eight ball on this one, because it's both a ubiquitous challenge and one that I think is largely misunderstood, and also just a lot of inconsistency across the government in terms of leadership direction and operational implementation. So I'll give you a couple of examples. I'm sometimes stunned by the number of people, senior acquisition officials, who continue to say that LPTA is just the one end of the best value spectrum in federal acquisition. We have this thing called best value. And the answer is no, it's not. It's if you say LPTA, it is actually a legal term that locks you into a decision matrix that says you have no flexibility. You have to give the contract award to the lowest bidder who is minimally technically acceptable. That does not mean you can't use an LPTA-type strategy in a what we call best value, which is what most people would think of as the smart way to buy. You weigh risk, you weigh various approaches, you can trade things off, price against performance and so forth, and come up with the best balance. You could certainly do that where price is the single most important factor and with limited trade-offs on technical, but it's not LPTA in a legal sense. There's a lot of factors driving it, and there's a lot of different explanations for it, and I don't think any one of them is either wrong or completely right. There are some folks who think LPTA has become common just because of the budget. There are others who say it's become common because folks think the contracts are too expensive. There are other folks who will tell you it's a strategy that's used to avoid protests. There are other folks who will tell you, and this is government folks come back and they'll say it's being used because it's increasingly difficult for the government to discern the differences between different proposals. I mean, proposal writing, and the art of proposal writing, and I mean that in the most positive sense, is a challenge. And in this environment with the pace of technology change and with the demographics and the demographic shifts taking place, it's increasingly difficult and a challenge, I think, of how we as industry approach the market and explain what we're bringing. So there's all kinds of explanations. I think we've made some progress at the leadership level. If you look at what Frank Kendall's done at the Department of Defense and his Better Buying Power initiative, made it quite clear that using low-price technically acceptable strategies for services is generally not a good idea because there's always some nuance or trade-off you may want to make, particularly as you get to the mid to higher end. Nonetheless, we still see it. There was a procurement, and I won't name the component of DOD, had a procurement for audit readiness support. Pretty sophisticated financial analysis and auditing. If you imagine the challenges DOD has in terms of getting audit ready.
Boy.
It was not only LPTA. It said there was no accounting experience required. So, you know, you can go to extremes like that and scratch your head. I think that at one point there were some Air Force officials who were toying with some new language just to get people thinking differently. But the bottom line from an industry perspective is we recognize, and I think everybody recognizes, there's an awful lot of stuff the government buys. You should be buying low price. There's even some services that are pretty commoditized, pretty basic, and you can buy them low price, and that's how the world works. The challenge is, as you get to the mid or higher end of the market, and you want to have a contractor or supplier base that has adequate capability to reinvest in people and in technology and really invest in excellence as opposed to just a commodity, you can't do it in an LPTA environment. And with the budget pressures now, we're seeing margins and we're seeing all kinds of levels of cost driven to dangerously low levels. And I'm not here to suggest that contractors should be able to, you know, be pulling 50% margins on everything they do. But what we're actually seeing is margins going from the reasonable to the unreasonable, not from the unreasonable to reasonable, if you will.
Right.
And you mentioned the Grant Thornton survey. Last year, one of the interesting findings was that about twice as, proportionally about twice as many companies now are seeing margins at 5% or less. When we are in a mid to high end marketplace, a 5% margin, frankly, is not a very high margin. I mean, just to be blunt about it. And when you look at what goes on in commercial technology and so forth, it creates real challenges for companies being able to attract talent because you just can't pay what you'd otherwise want to pay. And it was really the guts of a report we did for Secretary Panetta a couple of years ago. He asked us what we thought the budget cut impacts would be on our industry. And we said some segments of our sector will do okay because there's high priority programs, cybersecurity and data and analytics and those areas. We're much more concerned about the quality of the market. When you have constrained budgets and you with whatever kind of market you're in, it's an opportunity to actually winnow out the weak players and really strengthen the marketplace by really smart buying behaviors. And so that you come out of the downturn, if you will, with a much stronger, more agile, innovative supplier base, particularly given the last 10 years where the market has grown so much and you have lots and lots of players. If you're really heavily relying on a low price approach to buying, you're going to have exactly the opposite impact. You're going to incentivize the wrong behaviors and end up with a marketplace that's actually less agile, less innovative. And a lot of the better players will either walk away or they'll start just playing low-end games and not get you just cannot get the quality if the money's not there to pay for it.
Right. But, the the longevity factor here, keeping companies in the market, keeping companies engaged, LPTA is just a very unfriendly approach.
Well, it's not I agree with you. And also, as there's more and more talk these days about attracting new entrants into the market, new tech and so forth, I think what's going to happen there is as they get in and see these trends, they're also going to have many of the same problems.
Well, GSA, is it GSA or SBA? I forget who has this quick bid thing out there. And there's no mention on that website that you have to be in SAM, formerly CCR. There's no mention about any of the accounting things necessary. So you're inviting people into a game where they have no ideas of, you know, they think they're coming into football and they're going to end up playing cricket.
Well, and, you know, so getting into SAM and some of those basic things may not be that are not enormous barriers. People need to understand it. And if companies are coming in selling purely commercial services or items, there's some benefit there. But even there, we've seen regression in the government about how the government treats commercial items, audit requirements and post-award requirements and so forth. So I keep reminding myself or reminding people about DOD for years has had an authority called Other Transactions Authority. And OTA basically was designed as a tool. DARPA is the one that primarily uses it. Was designed as a tool to bring new entrants and new technology into the space. And a lot of the OTA money would flow through large integrators because they knew how to navigate, and these smaller new entrants didn't, so that was right. That was a good partnership. The biggest problem with other transactions was as they got the technology to the point where we would call it ready for production or go to market, they would transition back under the traditional FAR rules. And companies were saying, we can't, that's just creating the problem we were trying to avoid initially. I think as we move more and more, and it's an old saw by now, but more and more into technology and then the pace of technology and the need and the desire on the part of the government and the companies in this space to be able to bring new technology, new capabilities, innovation to the market, we have got to really think carefully about the barriers that are there and how they have been, in many cases, re-erected after years of trying to tear them down.
Okay. We're going to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We will be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Stan Soloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. You can find them at pscouncil.org. I suggest you do so. take a look at their membership program. It's a very vibrant and growing organization. Stan, there's a LPTA is it is what it is. But we have some other budget issues here. So give me your personal or professional take, whichever you prefer.
In this case, they're one and the same. I can say that safely. Look at it this way. Looking at it as a private sector organization supporting the government, one always wants to see, as in any market, a degree of predictability and clarity around where the customer is and what their capabilities are going to be. And that has completely disappeared from the federal space. The good news is we have the budget deal that was passed earlier this year, got full funding for the agencies for this current fiscal year, a little earlier than happened last year. We don't have the threat of sequester this year, although the impacts of sequester in some ways in terms of overall budget numbers are still there, but the specificity and the flow down requirements are not necessarily there. And we have a top line for the FY15 budget, so at least we kind of have a sense of where things are going to be. That's the good news. Oh, and the other piece of good news, of course, is we don't have a debt ceiling debate this year. That's for this year, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. And
year.
Well, it's not even a whole year. Remember, it was only 9 months, really.
Yeah, I know.
going into 15, we know, for instance, what the top line is going to be for the civilian agencies that's been agreed to. But there's not yet what we call the 302Bs, the allocations from the Appropriations Committee to tell us what agencies are going to get what funding. And there's debate about that. I mean, there's differences of opinion. And there is some talk that they are actually – and it's probably driven largely by it being an election year, relatively close to some agreements. We may see a set of appropriations bills this summer and actually have some appropriations done well before the end of the fiscal year, and that would be great. On the defense side, there are debates both within DOD and on the Hill as to how to spend the defense money that's been allocated at the top line. That probably won't be as big an issue this year, but I think going into 15 and then into 16, that becomes another issue all over again. So we bought ourselves a year of modest clarity, but not complete clarity, and it's still vexing the agencies. Then you have the pressures that occurred. You had a whole year. If you think about last year, we had a year where some agencies had four different spending plans in a period of 9 months. I mean, they were literally going from plan to plan, up and down, depending on the immediate activity. They rolled into this fiscal year with the civilian agencies essentially shut down, DOD having a partial shutdown. And you can see from the data that everything just stopped. I mean, procurement lead times have stretched unbelievably long. We've talked about it for years about how long it takes to acquire something. let's forget about how long it takes to field. Let's talk about how long it takes to get an RFP out and get an award made. You have a one large contract over at DOD that's going into 5 years now since the bids were submitted, and they're still asking companies to reaffirm their bids. And oh, by the way, it's a technology contract that doesn't even contemplate cloud, because cloud wasn't being contemplated 6 years ago. So you're talking about obsolete before even awarded. But procurement lead times, all of that is being driven by these budget pressures. And from a government agency perspective, it's just a horrible way to try to run a railroad, to try to keep programs online, to try to deliver what your mission says you're supposed to deliver. I might empathize and sympathize with federal employees and federal officials who are trying to execute in this environment. On the private sector side, the uncertainty and the lack of clarity is, creates just a whole other set of challenges, not only not knowing where your market's going to go, but cost, just sheer driving cost. I've submitted, there was a procurement at OPM that folks submitted on a little over a year ago called TMA. And there were literally about 400 bidders. And we estimate somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million in BMP total investment. And when at the point a year after submittal, when they were expecting the award, OPM just announced that we're canceling the contract, canceling the procurement. Those investments are gone. You have, in other cases where procurement lead time stretch, you can't plan a business. So the risk factors facing the private sector go up exponentially as the clarity goes down.
Right.
So on both sides of the equation, both for government agencies and for contractors, it's been pretty disastrous and pretty difficult to navigate.
This is almost sort of an emotional letdown here, but I wanted to touch on the travel issue as well. I mean, it seems kind of mundane next to the budget, but it's real. It's been here. It precedes a lot of the budget issues, but travel restrictions, have been, Diners Club built itself on the government travel. American Express won the contract by looking at the contract and telling GSA, we'll give you money if you give us this contract. That was basically their proposal. But, travel for government is huge, and it's necessary to a large degree, depending on what you do in the government. What's the impact of the travel restrictions on the feds and on industry?
Well, we've been very fortunate. It was unfortunate that our big annual conference happens to fall the beginning of the fiscal year. It's always the first of October. So we had the shutdown to deal with, and that's hopefully a unique circumstance. As I said, when we had our spring conference in Florida last month, or about a month and a half ago, we had pretty good attendance on the government side. So certain categories of folks are still finding ways to get out. But it has become a real challenge, and a lot of people have talked about, there was an overreaction to some travel problems, and then you add to that the budget pressures, and travel became an evil rather than something that could actually benefit how you do your work. And I think that for both government and industry, the ability to talk and collaborate, and we're not talking here in our case especially about specific procurements or anything, we're talking about sort of the business environment, how we can work better together, what the policy priorities might be that would help us, or the business processes that would help us, and so forth. So there's no sort of conflicts of interest or ethics issues involved. And I think, unfortunately, it's been around. It's gotten worse. It's loosened up in some cases, but people forget that it does have value. Now, there is also the other side that says, with technology today, whether you're talking about telepresence or a typical VTC, that you can do things you couldn't do 5 years ago, and that's true. But when you have a room of 200 and 250 people, and you're trying to have some sort of panel discussion where you really get into something, it's kind of hard to do it when people are remote.
Right.
It just doesn't have that same flavor, and there's no opportunity to really talks offline and one-on-one and what have you, which I think and have always thought has great value on both sides. So it's unfortunate that it's out there. But as you said about LPTA, it is what it is, and we work as best we can with it. And most of our government colleagues really try hard to get out and do what they can do. But I always worry that travel and training is the first thing to get cut in a tough budget environment. And both of those are critically important.
Well, back when you were in government and when I started consulting in the mid-80s, training for government was mandated by OPM, a minimum of 1 week per year for every federal employee, regardless of what they did. So even the guys doing maintenance, lawn care, they got training.
Right. In fact, I was told by one acquisition official from a sizable agency last year that in light of the budget crisis, they had canceled and eliminated all training funds for acquisition in their agency.
Good Lord. That's scary. Mm-hmm. How does this impact your all of this stuff? How does this impact your old stomping ground, DOD, and particularly the uniformed services?
DOD has, I've not noticed as much of a problem with travel, for specifically with DOD. We've had relatively good success in terms of people engaging both locally and when we've been remote. Senior leadership, I think, particularly over the last 3 years or so, has gotten better and better at engaging with industry. Even during the pre-sequester days, the secretary was reaching out more than I'd seen in a long time. So it hasn't had that huge an impact. But I will say that there have been pockets and periods over the last 5 years where we've heard stunning things at a DOD and other agencies. But even out of DOD, we don't meet with contractors, period. I had one company.
Predicated on.
Your guess is as good as mine. I had one company tell me yesterday, I was speaking at one offsite, one of our member companies, and they were saying that they're bidding on a fairly large contract. And the contracting officer said, I do not talk to anybody but my existing contractor because I have to. That's not to say the contracting officer is giving that contractor any inside scoop, but basically because we have an existing business relationship, I deal with that company, but I don't talk to anybody else. So there is, if you leave the travel issue aside, there's a lot of inconsistency. There's a piece in Washington Technology this morning that suggests that people think it's getting better in terms of the collaboration and communication. I'm not so sure that's true. I think if you ask Dan Gordon, you know, how effective he thought MythBusters was, which was his initiative, which I thought was one of the really good initiatives. I mean, he's an important one. He said at our conference just before he stepped down that the thing that stunned him was the resistance in the field on the government side to having conversations. Now, whether that's driven by fear of the oversight community accusing people of being too cozy or what, I'm not sure. But it's very inconsistent. And the final piece is, what about post-award? You know, if you look at some of the issues around debriefings and people really understanding why they didn't win contracts, you want to talk about protest drivers? Talk about quality of the starts with the quality of a debriefing. I mean, we saw in the 90s very clearly when debriefings were mandated, protests came down. Now you hear more and more people saying debriefings are very pro forma, that sometimes they're just emails. You really can't get any information. And people want to know and understand what happened, and they can learn from it. And so the travel is one piece of a broader component of collaboration.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you get the get the 4:55 Friday email or fax saying, here's your debrief, bye. So you have till Monday to find me to ask questions. What a weird world we live in. You are listening to AM Tower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Stan Soloway. He'll be back with me for 10 more minutes after these messages. Welcome back to AM Tower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower because nobody else volunteered. My guest is Stan Soloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. Find them, please, at pscouncil.org. Stan, you've gotten some expanded services for your members, and the community is in some sort of morph mode. Address that, if you will, as far as the start with your tech policy portfolio.
Well, we've been thinking since last summer about where the market itself is going in terms of how companies are going to market, offerings, the interplay between technology and services, which has always been there. I mean, we have a lot of companies that provide technology services to the government. It's obviously ubiquitous. But what we've really seen, and what really drove us to create a technology policy council and really make it one of our key areas of focus, is this what we call convergence of technology and services. A lot of the old lines that delineated between the professional services and the technology world have completely been obliterated. And you can see it. You mentioned Cisco earlier. You know, you think of Cisco as a company that basically does switches and routers and kind of physical hardware, mm-hmm. but their model is moving increasingly to as a service model.
Right.
You think about cloud is the perfect example of the marriage of services and technology, and it's going to be even broader than that. You hear talk about platforms as a service and broader infrastructure as a service and so forth. So we made a decision late last year that this was an area that if we were going to remain relevant and we were really going to remain as leaders in the community, we needed to get much deeper into. And so we created this Tech Policy Council, had tremendous response from our members. We have an executive advisory board of a half dozen people right now. It'll be expanding, but we've got senior officials from Cisco and IBM and Microsoft and Dell and so forth, real thought leaders on the topic.
Mm-hmm. And your advisory board really is a mini who's who, and you indicated to me before that you were adding to that sometime in the near term.
You'll be hearing more over the next couple of weeks of others that are coming onto that board as we really launch it. And I think that this convergence of technology and services is not only a market dynamic, it has an enormous business policy implications. If you talk to folks in government today about cloud, which everybody agrees we're going to cloud, there are a growing number of issues around how do you actually price cloud contracts and what's the right way to price it. There are different perspectives on it that don't always align with traditional government pricing models. We are in conversations now with the Office of Management Budget at their request to help them think through how do you budget for things like this, because there's no absolute. It's a fluctuating levels of need, and what resources are you going to need? I'm not sure. It's, you know, if you think of it as a utility, a water utility, you turn on your tap, you use the water, at the end of the month you get a bill. That's contrary to the way the government's used to budgeting. These are not arguments or debates of the traditional policy kind. This is, okay, the world's changing, how do we adjust? And this convergence is really where it's coming together. And we see dramatic changes in business relationships in the private side, business models on the government side. So that's a key focus. The other thing that ties into that is if you look across the landscape today of what's going on in acquisition and business policy, you have a heavy emphasis for obvious reasons on IT acquisition, but also continued emphasis, particularly on the defense side, on broader just general acquisition. You've got internal work being done at DOD. We have the House and Senate Armed Services are teaming up. Committees are teaming up to do a year-long acquisition review and policy set of policy recommendations next year. And so tying all that together really required us to kind of expand our horizons and our aperture. And it's not that it's all new to us. It's how we are actually organizing and aligning around to make sure we're getting at the right issues.
Well, a lot of your members prior to these changes were involved in all of these areas anyway.
Right.
They had all.
Of them, if you think about the companies on the initial advisory board, especially if you think about the IBMs and the Ciscos and the Microsofts, they're facing this in the commercial world.
Right.
This is not a new dynamic for them. Not a unique dynamic.
Is Amazon a member yet?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. I'm surprised. Whatever. Data center consolidation, cyber, I mean, all of these things are blending in here.
Right. This is all, they're all connected, even how data is collected, analyzed, used, through what systems and how you do it. All those pieces are part of this. I think that there's also, as we move more and more into mobility, and it's an area that I don't claim to be an expert on, but as we look at the mobility questions, in fact, one of the folks on the advisory board is, you know, the CEO of a mobile company, Osius, and AT&T has just come on board as well. There's going to be a number of issues they're beginning to face, and they're coming to me and saying, okay, we're going to identify a set of business policy issues. This is not about should we or shouldn't we. It's how do we make it work?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a set of issues there that we're going to end up dealing with.
It's somewhat more sophisticated than just the BYOD issue.
So. Yeah, it's more than just, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But and you know, then you layer security on top of all of this,
right?
Because I talk to some of my friends out at the fort on a regular basis, Fort Meade, and these are contractors, not people, employees. And they tell me, you know, there's some massive horror stories that never hit the news.
Well, I can't speak to that, but I can say that you talk to anybody on the government or industry side, this is an area that in our community that's pretty much people have locked arms on and recognize that there's. Somebody described it to me once. It's almost like a drug-resistant flu. It's you come up with a solution, but there's something else going to pop. You know, think about Heartbleed or something like that just happened last week. It is a dynamic environment, and everybody's trying to figure it out. We've got the NIST architecture now around cyber policy, which is very helpful. There are questions of how do you maintain a dynamic process because things are going to shift. So we all collectively have some big, big challenges in that area.
Yeah. You mentioned Balutis earlier. We probably both knew him when he was out at.
There you go. There you go. So,
that goes back a little ways. So do you want to touch on your policy issues for security clearances before we?
Well, I think that the security clearance issue is always on everybody's mind, and obviously with the Snowden and Alexis cases, it came into the forefront last year. The initial reaction was I'll be kind.
They were anomalies.
Well, the initial reaction that I found interesting was this shock about contractors actually having clearances, which is when I was in the Pentagon in the 1990s, we were trying to figure out why we had 550,000 people in the queue for security clearances. This is before 9/11, so that's not a new issue. We've kind of gotten over that shock. Anomalies or not, I think that I think OMB actually, when they came out with their report a few weeks ago, when the White House came out with its report, handled this really responsibly, and they deserve a lot of credit. What they basically said is, forget who you work for. This is about how we ensure appropriate monitoring. And so we do the appropriate kind of background checks, use resources appropriately, and then continuous monitoring. And they raised a number of areas that I think we all agree need to be addressed. The challenge that's going to remain for all of us, and this is not at this point an area where we're knocking heads, this is where we're talking about how do you make this work. It's not a contentious discussion, is what does continuous monitoring mean and what does it look like? I mean, and how does it potentially conflict with personnel privacy rules and HR policies and so forth? So if I really feel, and I think most of us would agree, there's got to be some degree of ability to monitor social media. Well, what does that mean? What does it look like? What about mental health? How do you define somebody and identify? There's some obvious cases. I mean, Alexis clearly had some very evident issues, and we can, you know, analyze that specific case. But how far do you go, and what is an employer's right, whether it's the government or a company? I think that's where a lot of the issues are going to evolve over the next 12 months, of how do you actually implement a continuous monitoring program that ensures to the degree you can security without completely obliterating other rules and law.
You know, I'm glad you're dealing with that, and I'm not. So, do you want to touch on the employee pay reporting?
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff coming out. I think whether it's employee pay reporting or the minimum wage for government contractors or the disability hiring rule, you know, none of which in and of itself you look at and philosophically or otherwise object to it. I think the issue is. And the president says it's because he can't get anything through Congress, and that may be a fair excuse, but it's getting to the point of how often are we just going to do things only to government contractors and put another set of unique rules and requirements on
right.
them? You know, the minimum wage issue was actually one of the more interesting because it got a lot of coverage, and its impact is actually going to be really, really minor because government contractors who have wage grade employees are subject to the Service Contract Act, so the government tells them what to pay.
Right.
And it's very few and far between. Cases where the Department of Labor is saying pay less than $10.10 an hour. Now, if there are some cases, fine, raise it up to $10.10. That's not an issue for the companies because it's a level playing field. It's not like somebody can come in and undermine you and so forth. And no one wants to be in a situation where you're being rapacious on wages to take advantage of the marketplace. I mean, we've all sort of signed up to that as being part of this community. So it was very minor, but it would the messaging about, you know, we're solving a problem as if these companies were out there paying substandard wages or not paying benefits and so forth, when they're required to by law in 9 times out of 10.
Right.
So I think, you know, there's a number of personnel actions or executive orders that have come out that make you bristle a little bit because not because of what they're targeted at doing, but because they're unique. And it's if we're going to deal with it, let's deal with it as a broader community.
It is what it is. Stan, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Mark. It's always good to see you.
And you, and when the grant report comes out, let's get back together and talk about it on air. Great. You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This is not my day job. If you are looking for some outside advice to improve your marketing, give me a shout. And if your company needs training on LinkedIn, I have both public courses and in-house training available. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.